This is Susan Livingston reporting for Sequitur for Expressions of Peace Radio. Expressions of Peace, personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart. Sequitur is archived under the Expressions of Peace tab at panina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action. With habitat loss, ecological collapse, and consequent impending extinction as its main themes, Sequitur is a discussion of the natural consequences of actions at the individual, community, cultural, and species levels. Sequitur, it follows. Sequitur, the theme song, is by Zimpht. That's Z-Y-M-P-H-T. You can find more of his music on SoundCloud. Sequitur originated as the Global Extreme Weather segment on Extinction Radio. The weather and climate news felt too urgent to abandon when Extinction Radio went on hiatus last spring, so Sequitur became a freestanding podcast. Inspired by Guy McPherson's Nature Bats Last, the focus of Sequitur expanded beyond extreme weather events and natural disasters to consider the overarching issue of habitat loss. Sequitur's content further expanded under the influence of Derek Jensen's book, The Myth of Human Supremacy, to cover extinction events and their drivers for the whole web of life, rather than only property destruction and loss of human life or monetized livelihood. Aho, Mitakwe Owasan, we are all related. Sequitur's Soulful Recovery was named in honor of my featured guest today, my shamanic mentor, Linda Star Wolf. I met Star Wolf when she offered Awakening the Inner Shaman as a summer program with the Evolver Network in 2012, her first ever webcam offering, where I experienced a profound awakening. Our relocations had crossed. She and her late husband, Brad Collins, a shaman in his own right, had moved from the West Coast to the Blue Ridge Mountains of Western North Carolina right about the same time I moved from Southwestern Virginia to the San Francisco Bay Area. I used some of my late mother's legacy to organize a half-day workshop featuring Star Wolf in Berkeley in March of 2013. I called it Shamanic Breathwork for Peace and Nonviolence. Expressions of Peace, Breathe Peace documents some of that event. That 30-minute video is archived on the Vimeo channel at vimeo.com/expressionsofpeace. The next year saw me as a rental crunch refugee in exile back in Asheville, North Carolina, just an hour's drive from Star Wolf's beautiful Isis Cove, and I was able to attend the last Wise Wolf Council in May 2015, as well as a half-day workshop in August 2016. This year, I plan to attend the Blue Star Council, a weekend retreat centered around the solar eclipse in August. They say wolves have enormous ranges, and it's a good thing Star Wolf likes to travel and have adventures, because when one has a thriving career doing presentations and lives in a remote area, one must travel long distances to work. Besides appearances from coast to coast for trainings and retreats, mostly in collaboration with former students, there have been recent excursions to Bali, Mexico, and South Africa, and I think there's another trip to Egypt coming up soon. I have a hard time keeping up with her magical mystery tour, but then I don't travel anymore. But if such spiritual journeys interest you, details can be found on the events page at shamanicbreathwork.org, where you will find links to upcoming events as well as to books she has authored or co-authored, featured on the homepage and in the sidebars. Shamanic Breathwork is the model Star Wolf has developed for guiding groups on the journey within. It is different from much of the trendier journey work that's going on these days in that it doesn't rely on plant medicine for transportation. Star Wolf uses group process, chakra-attuned music, and individualized coaching with a sort of rapid yet deep breathing to stimulate the brain to secrete its own psychoactive chemicals. So the technique is highly accessible to those who are not tolerant of other forms of vision quest. Shamanic breathwork is different enough from other forms of breathwork that Star Wolf was able to register a trademark for it. Yet it is similar enough to other forms that those who have studied Tai Chi or yoga or holotropic breathwork will experience themselves as being in familiar territory. I had been wanting to interview Star Wolf ever since Sequitur Wetiko, but she was out of the country. She said maybe March would be best, since she would be back at home and working to meet April publication deadlines, but we'd best schedule it a couple of months in advance. I didn't get back to her until after the 1st of March, so perhaps you can imagine my surprise when she said she'd like to do the interview that same weekend. So, sooner than predicted, to spin a phrase, I am happy to bring you Linda Star Wolf. I dare say in another couple of weeks I could have brought her to you with better sound quality, as I'm in the process of transitioning from Skype to Zoom. But I hope you will overlook the patchy sound quality in light of the enormity of the content. The first 15 minutes was on Skype, but the echo got so bad on her end that we switched to my free conference calling line, which can only ever be as good as the tinny mics they put in phones these days. And since we were uncertain how much of the Skype recording was going to be useful, we sort of started over. So, dear listeners, I give you a two-part interview with Linda Star Wolf, with a cultural enhancement as an interlude between the two parts. Okay, we've got a signal. Let me get back to my Skype screen here so I can see your lovely face.
Good to see you.
You too. I sort of made myself an outline, some of the things that have been on my mind. I ordered the book, I just finished reading it, called Columbus and Other Cannibals.
Oh, yeah.
By indigenous historian Jack D. Forbes.
Right.
And that's all completely organized around Wetiko. Wetiko is personified as a monster that eats people. In other words, a cannibal. And
right. So
we've even consumed the title Americans. We are not Americans. We are Europeans.
Right.
You know, the indigenous people of this continent had even their name taken from them and concluded that Wetiko is endemic in European culture. Not that it's unknown in indigenous culture, but it's considered a mental disorder, basically, cannibalism. And that's as distinguished from the eating of flesh for honorary reasons.
Right.
You know, there's some traditions around that too. But that's a different thing entirely. That has nothing to do with Wetiko.
Right.
Wetiko is very closely connected to greed, which is taking more than we need and giving nothing back.
Mm-hmm. For me, what it's correlated to is consumerism. I think that cannibalism is consumerism, and I'm going to ask that this become a Star Wolf quote. Consumerism is cannibalism run amok in consumerism. I was in Bali in Indonesia recently, and I was there. I was speaking to an old shadow meister friend of mine who's written several books on the shadow, including The Shadow in America and Meeting the Shadow, Jeremiah Abrams. And really, I think that his book, Meeting the Shadow, was truly the best shadow book that I read. And I read all of them during that time. And as it became more popular in our culture to start actually looking at shadow,
uh-huh.
I actually started teaching in shadow workshops close to 25 years ago, maybe longer, actually, when it first really began to be more popular and not just something for those who were kind of elite and doing psychoanalysis, lying on the couch with a psychoanalytic practice, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we were speaking about cannibalism in the ancient or not even that ancient traditional Indonesian culture and about what it really meant and a whole flesh ceremony and that sort of thing. Of course, it was misunderstood by the civilized world, so to speak, that came into those places. But cannibalism as it is now, using that metaphor in our culture and worldwide, to me, is really a culture or a world of people who are eating themselves, only eating everything around them. not realizing that we're not in balance with ourselves. We're not in balance with the shamanic world. We're not in a balance with water, earth, fire, and air around us, that we're consuming all of it. And we're not really letting it be released again.
I'm thinking about the epidemic of immune disorders and cancer. Yeah. It makes perfect sense. It's more than just a metaphor, isn't it?
It really is more than just a metaphor. Of course, in my world, all metaphors are real.
Yes.
You know, all archetypes, all mythologies, as Joseph Campbell, the great mythologist, said, are real. And we're either living the mythological life consciously, or we're playing it out unconsciously. We're either waking up and living it and making it conscious and taking responsible action towards realizing how powerful we really are, that in some way we are the gods ourselves,
mm-hmm.
taking responsibility for that, or we're pretending that we're children, that we need to be dependent upon fate and everything outside of us. And that really is our more unconscious state of being as we're coming out of this more twilight world as human beings and into the light of day and standing up and facing the tag, we're it. We are the ones we've been waiting for. We are the great mothership. We are the return of Jesus. We are Kuan Yin. We are whatever it is that we've been asking to come and save us. It lives inside of us as well as outside of us.
We need to talk about how shamanism and shamanic practice, ceremony, ritual can address our shadow.
Well, you know, the shadow is something, quite frankly, that's very near and dear to my heart. And I think that it is one of the most important aspects of human beings individually, as well as in groups. In a world that is obviously full of shadow right now, the outer world, the most obvious thing that's right under our own noses is that the shadow in the world does not exist without shadow in human beings. And the shadow in human beings is what creates the projected shadow as a collective consciousness in the world. So if you look at it from that perspective, really the atrocities in the world that we're horrified by or have no wish to be simply can't exist unless they live in the hearts and minds of human beings. Animals are in a balance with the world, the trees, the rivers, the environment. So they're not really casting a shadow. When an animal acts in a certain way, it's acting from very much from its nature. And it's acting, unless it's been affected in a negative way, quite frankly, by human beings and what's happening to its natural environment, they will act in a harmonious way for the good of the whole of their collective energy field. At the other beings in that field, whether it's other animals, trees, rivers, they do not affect things in a negative way. If there is an overabundance of a particular species, nature will take care of it. It's very different with human beings. Human beings have a different kind of consciousness that actually represses parts of itself so that we can't actually see it. And the way that we do get to see it is how it shows up in the world. And that shows up through the actions of people. So many times, if we're denying something in ourselves, we will project it out. For instance, homophobia. There's been so many times that we hear people who are extremely homophobic, and later on, then something comes out in the news where someone's caught in a bathroom in an airport. The same with people judging people and thinking that they should pull themselves up by their own bootstraps and there shouldn't be social welfare of any kind. Meanwhile, that person frequently is a person who has been handed privilege in some way through either numerous opportunities or through an inheritance or trust fund or some way in which they've never had to pull themselves up. This is something that frequently comes across, is that people will project out something into the world that they don't want to be, that's repressed within them, and then sooner or later it'll show up through some action. This is Carl Jung, who really made the concept of the shadow quite famous in his teachings.
I found the Jung quote, and I wanted to offer that up. He said, "Until you make the unconscious conscious, it will direct your life and you will call it fate."
That's right. But it's really just the wheel turning and energies catching up with us that we've been projecting out that come back finally as a reflection to us. So I believe that the shadow itself is a great mirror for us. And so I've been on the leading edge, or the cutting edge, I want to say, for a long time of investigating my own shadow, quite frankly, because I got tired of suffering. I got tired of my addictions. I got tired of being powerless to my own subconscious mind. And in that process of healing and transforming myself and finding some humility and being willing to roll up my sleeves and do the hard work of growing up and being an adult child of God or the universe instead of a child, which meant healing my inner child and stepping into my own power and opening to my own shamanic spirit, that was really my motivation for doing my own inner work in that way. And the more I worked with shadow, I began to realize that what was in my shadow was my inner shaman. And the more I worked with individuals worldwide with their shadows, what I realized is they were not owning their own inner shaman. And let me speak about what I mean by that. In the shamanic world, we really are looking to balance, not only in the outer world to recreate the balance, the natural balance in our environment, which is, of course, incredibly off for numerous reasons. The great oceans that are being affected by the meltdowns of the nuclear power plants or overfishing, the great forest and trees that are being burned down for palm oil in Indonesia and around the world, and all the many creatures that create the ecological balance, such as the wolves, as apex predator in America and in other places around the world, and the lion in Africa. And as these creatures, especially the lions and certain types of wolves, border sometimes on extinction, that all of these beings create the balance of the waters, the fire, the earth, the air. And if we can begin to own our own shadow, which is that we are shamanic, it's our birthright. And Grandmother Twilinich of the Seneca Nation, my adopted grandmother, said that all of us are native to the earth. Each one of us has a shamanic birthright, and not only right to balance our own, but a responsibility to then do our right in the world. In other words, our ritual in the world of helping to keep the balance. So it brings a whole different awareness and consciousness to us when we realize that we have a shaman within that we need to reawaken and bring into consciousness, who can help us deal with our shortcomings and our shadows and transmute them and transform them and help us to become the best that we are, knowing that we're not perfect, but making those great strides and making, as my friend Jeremiah would say, the moral effort to see the difference between right and wrong and to be able to know what that is, because we can see the imbalances in ourselves, and then we can therefore see them in the world instead of just being a victim and say, oh, look at the world, it's going to really see those imbalances and then to make the moral effort to change them within ourselves and then to reflect that back out into the world.
And I'm absolutely fascinated by the connection that you're drawing between the cultural shadow and the personal shadow, that they really are one and the same. And that ties right back to the mirror neuron research, which basically says that we wouldn't be able to look at a Donald Trump and say, oh, he's impulsive, if we didn't ourselves have that impulsivity trait lying within us in our shadow. And that's exactly the kind of mirroring that we need desperately in this overblown consumer addicted culture that we're living in.
Donald Trump is a great shadow for many of us. And it shows really the division in the United States of our culture, but it also shows a division in the world And I think one of the biggest things that it's doing, this whole thing, Make America Great Again, is this call to this kind of simpler mind, you know, and our consciousness of kind of wanting to climb back in the womb and to go back to some idealized time when it was just our country and we didn't have to worry about other countries, when we just worried about our town or our people or our race or whatever, and we didn't have to worry about the sixth mass extinction that's upon us. We didn't have to worry about the waters all over the world. We didn't have to worry about the atmosphere, the surrounding the whole world. We could just worry about our neighborhood. And things now are in such global proportion, and it's so big. It's so huge that I think it's overwhelming for people's minds sometimes. And it's kind of, we begin almost this, well, just take care of my little pocket and make sure that everybody's okay in my neck of the world. It comes from a feeling of overwhelm, I think. So we have a Big Daddy Warbucks, with lots of money and lots of promise. He's going to make America great again. He's going to take care of all of us, and we can just be children. And of course, at this time on the planet, none of us can be children any longer. Children can barely even be children anymore with all the dying, starving children in Syria and the refugee children and Darfur and all over, and in America too, in the slums of our cities. You know, even children can't be children anymore. So it's not a time to be children. It's not a time to disappear into the Neptunian world. You know, we certainly have to find our place of respite and set by the still waters. But this is a time of fire on the planet. We're in the fires of transformation. And it's time for us to look at our own shadows individually and collectively.
That concludes part one of the two-part interview. And now for our cultural enhancement, I'm going to share with you an excerpt from another book I read recently. Like most nature lovers, I was familiar with the work of James Audubon and John Muir, but it wasn't until a recent Nature Bats Last podcast that I heard Guy McPherson mention Aldo Leopold as one of the founding fathers of conservation biology. Leopold's work was independently recommended to me almost simultaneously by Zimft as the originator of the notion of a land ethic. Those two words, land ethic, go straight to the heart of my admiration for indigenous wisdom and my support of the Standing Rock Water Protectors. So I got a copy of a Sand County Almanac and sketches here and there, written in 1949, and I've prepared an excerpt for you from one of those here and there sketches. But first, the backstory. On 11 May 1947, in Wyalusing State Park, the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology had dedicated a monument to the passenger pigeon, which had gone extinct half a century earlier due to a combination of overhunting and deforestation. And by the way, the name passenger is actually a bastardization of the French passager, which indicates that the species was migratory, unlike the sedentary urban pigeons that are so plentiful today. Now I give you a sample of Aldo Leopold's moving, poetic, and prophetic prose from his essay on a monument to the pigeon. It is a century now since Darwin gave us the first glimpse of the origin of species. We know now what was unknown to all the preceding caravan of generations, that men are only fellow voyagers with other creatures in the odyssey of evolution. This new knowledge should have given us by this time a sense of kinship with fellow creatures, a wish to live and let live, a sense of wonder over the magnitude and duration of the biotic enterprise. These things, I say, should have come to us. I fear they have not come to many. Our grandfathers were less well-housed, well-fed, well-clothed than we are. The strivings by which they bettered their lot are also those which deprived us of pigeons. Perhaps we now grieve because we are not sure in our hearts that we have gained by the exchange. The gadgets of industry bring us more comforts than the pigeons did, but do they add as much to the glory of the spring? For one species to mourn the death of another is a new thing under the sun. The Cro-Magnon who slew the last mammoth thought only of stakes. The sportsman who shot the last pigeon thought only of his prowess. The sailor who clubbed the last auk thought of nothing at all, but we, who have lost our pigeons, mourn the loss. Had the funeral been ours, the pigeons would hardly have mourned us. In this fact, rather than in Mr. DuPont's nylons or Mr. Vannevar Bush's bombs, lies objective evidence of our superiority over the beasts. The pigeon loved his land. He lived by the intensity of his desire for clustered grape and bursting beechnut, and by his contempt of miles and seasons. Whatever Wisconsin did not offer him gratis today, he sought and found tomorrow in Michigan or Labrador or Tennessee. His love was for present things, and these things were present somewhere. To find them required only the free sky and the will to ply his wings. To love what was is a new thing under the sun, unknown to most people and to all pigeons. To see America as history, to conceive of destiny as a becoming, to smell a hickory tree through the still lapse of ages, all these things are possible for us, and to achieve them takes only the free sky and the will to ply our wings. In these things, and not in Mr. Bush's bombs and Mr. DuPont's nylons, lies objective evidence of our superiority over the beasts. Unquote. I invite you to visit aldoleopold.org. That's AldoLeopold. To find out more about his work, and perhaps order some of his writing or some of his artwork or other commemorative items. I got a refrigerator magnet with the following words of wisdom printed over a prairiescape. Quote, "There are two things that interest me, the relation of people to each other and the relation of people to land." Unquote. Or better still, you can plan a visit to the Leopold Center in Baraboo, Wisconsin. And now, before we resume our visit with Linda Starr Wolf, I remind you that you are listening to Sequitur, a production of Expressions of Peace, personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart. Sequitur is archived at panina.org, that's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action. Okay, you're on, Starr Wolf.
I wanted to speak into what you and I were talking a little bit before we began the interview, about the concept of Wetiko and how I see that. We were speaking about a type of cannibalism, and we were talking about the difference between the cannibalism that you found perhaps in ancient indigenous cultures, and actually some people say there are some in remote places that are still actually practicing cannibalism. But that really had to do with more of a cultural honoring of the flesh. And people who've studied anthropology and different cultures really understand that. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about a type of cannibalism that is not based in any of that kind of cultural roots at all. The type of cannibalism that we're speaking about now is a part of our shadow. And what I believe is that our consumerism has turned into a type of cannibalism where we're not only consuming everything around us with this kind of greed, with this kind of taking without giving back, but also that we're beginning even to consume ourselves, where we're actually feeding on ourselves and wasting away. And we can see this happening all around the world. We've forgotten this is a shamanic world and that we're interconnected, and that if we're not balancing the elements of water and air and fire and earth, which we're all made up of within ourselves, and taking our shamanic birthright, our shamanic responsibility to care for ourselves and to balance those things, which means not overeating or overpopulating or being out of balance with our outer elements, that if we're not balancing in both worlds, in the outer and the inner, then we have indeed become cannibals in the worst sense of the word. And that shadow that we don't even realize that we've projected. So we look out in the world with this fear that we're not going to get enough. We're not going to have enough food. We're not going to have enough weapons of mass destruction. You know, we're not going to have all these things
And so we take more and more and more, and we hoard. So we really cannot stop the flow of energy and hoard things and be in this greed and consumerism that I must have all this and consume, because we will really mass destruct. And of course, we're seeing that worldwide in so many ways. You know, burn all the trees down so that we can have palm oil that goes into almost every product that's on the grocery shelf. So we burn down all the trees, so then we affect the air. Or we have the canned camp with lions, with wolves, with different creatures all over the world where people can go and, you know, for $500,000, shoot a white lion and bring its head back and put it on the wall, you know, as some sort of status symbol, because there's some way in which I've conquered this outer beast. It's on the internet and it's on Facebook. We almost would have to be completely cut off from media these days not to see the shadow of what's happening all around the world. And yet at the same time, a good portion of people are choosing to let their shadows act out in addiction so it can numb them from the fear of not having enough and then also not being able to do anything about it, not having the power to do anything about this massive cannibalistic Wetico shadow of consumerism.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how you're using the word addiction. I know that you're using it in a broader sense than somebody who's addicted to some pharmaceutical substance. There's a lot more to it than that.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Well, addiction is always about a lack of self. Addiction is always about a lack of power. It's always about there's some place inside myself where I sense that I have disconnected, disassociated, or dislocated, and where I have had soul loss. And there's part of me missing. So I need to fill it up with something. I need to replace it with something artificial, because part of me is missing. And when a part of us is missing, if we don't actually discover what that part is and bring it back, which is the true meaning of soul retrieval, and now I refer to it as soulful recovery, soul-filled recovery. If we don't bring those parts of ourselves back, what we then do is we replace it with substitutes for love. We replace it with people, places, and things. And, of course, there's nothing wrong with bringing people in our lives to love us, you know, and making connections or enjoying the things that we have. I certainly love to travel and see things and have adventures. But when that's taking the place of a hole that's inside of us, it's a large gaping wound, and it's like an endless black hole, and that's where addiction comes from. And we can be addicted to anything. We can get addicted to Facebook and just constantly be feeding that into our psyches. We can be addicted, of course we know, to substances such as drugs, alcohol, food. We can be addicted to pornography, which is a huge addiction right now for men and women, and it's really flourishing right now in the teenage population. In one of my books, I think it was in Shamanic Breathwork, I have a chapter called The Shaman and the Shadow, and I put a subtitle there of something that came to me once, and that was that the difference between a shaman and an addict was sobriety. And what I meant is not just being sober, meaning not drinking, although that is a form of sobriety for an alcoholic. But sobriety means really being awake. It means being alert, sober, vigilant, being able to see and have your senses turned on like the wolf, to have these canine abilities to really see and perceive and hear and tune in, to wake up. And it's really hard to be awake when you're dulling the senses with an addiction. So addiction is our way of dealing with some aspect of our shadow, of what's missing, of what's been projected or lost. We frequently speak about the negative shadow, but there's also the positive shadow. I remember some years ago, people would say, oh, if you must write a book about all the things you're doing. And I just, I couldn't write a book. Well, this year, I'm my ninth book. So there was some part of me that had to heal and say, y'all got it, I'm smart enough to write a book. In fact, I'm smart enough to write nine. So the sobriety piece helps us wake up, own who it is that we are, and then in my world, it's about becoming a shaman. And about what that really means, it's not a glorified thing at all. It just simply means owning who it is that we came here to be, our birthright. We came here to balance ourselves and then to help contribute to the world around us in a balanced way, because nature already balances itself And now human nature has to learn how to live with Mother Nature and fit into that equation and how to be a part of that balance and maybe enhance it instead of destroy it.
Maybe just remember it rather than figure it out. Seems to me we knew these things once upon a time, didn't we?
In our primitive state, we absolutely knew. We were closer in our primitive state to the natural world. We were closer to animals. When I was in Africa last year, there's been discoveries in the caves there and remnants of human beings, but it's not because they think that the animals in the caves ate the humans. They now believe that the lions and the form of wild dogs there that were actually their form of wolves and human beings walked side by side, hunted together, and lived in caves together and kept each other warm. In some ways, you know, we talk about domesticating animals. You could say that animals just domesticated humans, learned that they had to be in balance. They couldn't kill all the antelope or all the woolly mammoths if they wanted to survive the winter. But they were going to need to learn from their elder brothers and sisters, the wolves and the lions, how to only take what they needed. And then after they had taken what they needed, to leave the rest for the vultures to come, for the jackals to come, for the dung beetles to come, and for the hyenas to come, for the other things to come, because there was a way in which everything in nature must benefit. It must serve the good of the whole in order for all of us to be in balance.
This sounds like the zero waste movement, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely. Now, we were speaking politically earlier, and, you know, one of the things I think that has happened for humanity is as we've come out of that kind of more primitive state where we were in a type of balance with nature itself, and as evolutionary processes happened, and perhaps even visitations from other cultures or other beings, maybe even connection with star beings or planetary travel, those kinds of things, and maybe even interbreeding with all of that. At the same time, there is a neglect of that nature part of it. There's a way in which we've kind of left that behind. I believe that we need to bring along with us, because if we separate ourselves too far from nature, there will be no nature left to nurture us and to allow those somewhat enlarged brains, minds, and egos to continue to create the things that it's creating. And so one of the things I think that's happening on the planet, the same time that human beings have kind of individuated, if you will, from Mother Nature, there's a way in which, in many ways, we want to look to certain things to save us. We want to look to science to save us. We want to look to our rational minds to save us in some way. And I'm not sure save us from what. Maybe save us from the simple fact that we are part of nature, that we all are going to be born, live our lives, go through experiences, and return to nature in that deathing and rebirth process. But one of the things I've really seen in this kind of separation, that there's also kind of a dumbing down emotionally, a dumbing down instinctually or intuitively. And especially what I'm noticing in the last few decades, it feels like to me that human beings really want someone to save them. So maybe that's always been, you know, something in, I guess you could say, in the subconscious of children, is wanting to be protected by their parents. But adult human beings wanting to be saved by some mainly father figure. And looking out at the world right now, it feels to me that politically that's what has happened, especially with our last election, with someone who has unlimited wealth, unlimited access to almost everyone and everything in the world. Just as a status symbol or an archetypal symbol, that the president, especially the United States, is seen as the most powerful person in the world. Who's been elected is this multi-billionaire person who has all this power, who could conceivably be the great daddy of us all, who could make all these changes, could do all these things for good. And I can't help but wonder even if the president himself maybe believes that. Maybe there's a part of him that believes when he stands and says, I'm going to make America great again. I'm going to do these things in a certain way. There's almost this misguided patriarchal and paternal energy believing that overall that the American people and the world wants him to be kind of a dictator. Because, you know, when you're a little kid, dad's kind of our dictator. Parents kind of are. This is what you're going to do. This is what you're going to eat. This is where you're going to sleep. This is the way it's going to be. I know better than you, and I'm going to make the decision, right? You don't need to know too much. Don't you worry your pretty little head about it. I'll take care of it. And I think that there's kind of a massive overload in people's psyches right now from all the technology, from all the warnings about global warming. I think that many people hope it's not true. They hope it's just kind of a boogeyman in the closet, that oil is leaking in massive gallons into rivers, streams, and oceans, that nuclear power plants are breaking down, that massive tree destruction is destroying our atmosphere, along with the oil addiction. Speaking about addiction, the great oil addiction that we all have. There's no one on the planet that's not addicted to oil, hardly. Probably maybe some few primitive people, but almost everyone is addicted to oil. We want the conveniences that oil brings us still.
Especially if you include plastic, which is, after all, a petroleum product.
Absolutely. I mean, the phone I'm holding has a certain amount of plastic in it. Everywhere. You don't even know that it's there. So here's this massive energy that's so overwhelming that we all know, and that we're repressing a lot of it into subconscious, that is so destructive and feeling so overwhelmed that maybe Daddy can come along and take care of it for us. And maybe we won't blow ourselves off the planet or kill everything off and become extinct ourselves and not leave anything behind for the generations to come. And so that's a big part of where consciousness is. Now, do I think that good can come out of something that feels so repressive and regressive? Well, I know for a fact it can. You know, Susan, I worked in the addictions field, the mental health field. It was my first profession from the time I was 20 years old. And as an addiction specialist, as a mental health professional, more in the world of psychology and psychiatry and mental health. And what I witnessed repeatedly is that people frequently did not change until they hit bottom. People don't change until they have an uncomfortable level of suffering. Now, the good news is many of us are getting to a point where we're no longer willing to turn to substitutes for love. That's what addiction is, and false relief, and we're no longer willing to suffer as badly as we have in the past. We're raising the bottom. We want to proactively notice when we're suffering and say, that hurt. This is not good. I don't want to run from it. I don't want to use anything to get rid of it. I want to face it. I want to deal with it, and I want to change it, and I want it to get better for all of us. And that's called sobriety. It's what shamans have always done. Shamans have always worked in their tribes and villages all over the world to help make things better, whether it was somebody that had an illness, whether it was a problem in the village, whatever it might be, they sought to restore the balance of the elements within the people or the environment or the situation and to help things get better. So when I call for people to awaken their shaman within and to come back to water, earth, fire, air, and spirit, I'm really calling on that inner shaman that no longer can rely on just a tribal shaman. There's 7.5 billion of us on the planet, and it's time for all of us to use those God-given or Goddess-given or Creator-given powers that are innate, that are hidden within our own DNA, that are waking up to step into our own authentic power now. So with this election, maybe more so than any in a really long time, maybe ever, we get to see our shadow. And say, do I really want to be a little child? Do I really want to have loss of power and say so over my life? Who I marry, what I eat, where I sleep, how I work, my health, everything. Do I want to turn that all over to someone else? Or do I want to be involved in helping to create a better balance for myself in the world? So I think each one of us is getting the opportunity right now to ask that question, not only ask it, but then to say, so what is mine to do?
What is mine to do? That really strikes at the heart of it. What is mine to do?
It's really true, Susan. I mean, everybody can do something, even if it's keeping other people aware by posting, to the best of our knowledge, what we know to be true as real news, as real events, and letting the world know there's 1.5 billion people on Facebook. Not the best way always to communicate. Sometimes we need to visit somebody or call them up or write them a letter, right? But there's 1.5 billion people on Facebook. That's how the Arab Spring happened. That's how the 2 to 4 million March for Humanity happened last month in such vast numbers. So why not use the technology that we have to help bring forth, instead of just controversy or gossip, to do our best to bring forth real facts, or as close as we can, of what we know and shared information. The way people have always been able to make change, that's why the freedom of press is so important, is to share information. On a very personal level, we can do our best to take care of ourselves, to find out and discover how to feed ourselves and how to live just ourselves each day in a better balance. That's something that's a very individualized thing, just like certain plants need a lot of water, some need more soil, some you can even have air plants. Animals, certain animals will live in the desert, some live in caves, some live in the ocean, some live in trees. People are individualized. But for each person just to simply not be a part of a flock or a herd, but to individually begin to discover what it is they need for their personal needs each day to care for themselves. That's a huge beginning. Some people are very introverted, hardly ever need to see anybody. Some people need to be with people a lot.
Yeah.
The skill we need to acquire is the skill to give and receive useful feedback, and that definitely takes another person. We have to be in connection with at least one other person if we're going to get any feedback at all, because along with our shadow, we have a blind spot. It's hard to see our own shadow without another person to hold up a mirror.
It's so true. Animals show us our shadows, too. It's funny because if I've been on the computer too long, my dog will come. He'll throw his bone at me. He'll throw his toy at me. He'll, you know, try to get me to play. And then if I ignore him, you know, he'll sit there and he'll look at me pleadingly and pathetically, you know, trying to make me feel sorry for him. And then if I still don't get it, then he'll go over and lie on the couch where I have to see him on his back with his paws in the air like he's dreaming that he's running and like he's dissociative. Like, finally I'm like, okay, you need a walk. And he's going, no, you need a walk. So, you know, to have something living around us, people, animal, will show us our shadow. There's no way it doesn't show our shadow.
Well, I'm feeling like we should probably wrap up here, and I want to give you a chance before I turn off the recording to say what you're working on. I know we had to wait until this month until you returned from your travels, and you've got publication deadlines coming up next month, so I'm very interested in getting a sneak preview on what it is you're writing.
Well, I'm writing on two major projects. Actually, I just completed the book that comes out hopefully May 1st, and I'd like to mention my co-author, Nita Gage, my dearest friend and colleague for close to 30 years now. She lives out in the San Francisco Bay Area, and we'll actually be out there in July, right after the 4th, and we've co-authored a book together called Soul Whispering and the Art of Awakening Shamanic Consciousness. It comes out through Inner Traditions International, Bear & Company, and that book is really the collective wisdom of Nita and my individual and separate and also collective journey and how they've intertwined with one another throughout the years. Hers more from the medical field, mine more from the psychological field, and how we both stepped into our shamanic path and have taken that back out into the world in an effort to help restore the balance to ourselves and to the world, listening to our own soul whispering and helping others listen to their soul whispering and being able to be soul whisperers for others until they can hear their own. Also, right before we got online today, I was sitting here writing for a book that's coming out on Sacred Messengers of the 31st Meridian. That's the working title, and Shamanic Mysteries of Africa. And my co-author with that is Carly Matamore, who came through my program as a student, and then we've become very close friends and colleagues. She lives in Springfield, Illinois. And I was just sitting here writing right before we started to talk on the meditation, shamanic journey meditation, about our journey to Africa last year and being at the oldest medicine wheel, the calendric calendar called Adam's calendar, that scientists have found, 75 to 150,000 years old. And
wow.
What it means to become a sacred warrior, especially at this time, and what that means, a sacred spiritual warrior. So that book is being written and will come out sometime next spring. And I just found from Teotihuacan, where we took 29 people through some powerful shamanic initiations, where we entered at the beginning of the lunar eclipse and came out on top of the Pyramid of the Sun at the solar eclipse, and chanting in Mexico on the top of the Pyramid of the Sun, bring down the wall. Bring down the walls that divide us and keep us from love and community and global consciousness and keeps us from the true magic. I do want to put a plug in for a couple of events we have coming up. I'm going to be in Sedona with Don Miguel Ruiz and a group of people there in April for Gathering of the Shamans, a weekend with a lot of shamanic teachers. I think there's probably about 300 people that show up for that. You can find it on my Linda Starwell Facebook page. I also have a Shamanic Mysteries of Egypt Mystery School starting here at my home at Loveland. And I also, in May, have a month-long intensive training shamanic immersion coming up here at my home in the mountains. We have people coming from Australia, England, and all over the country for that for a month. We're going to be at a mega institute, open center, lots of other places. But at the end of the year, we'll be taking a group to explore the mysteries in Egypt and the sacred temples there. So it's a big year, two books coming out. Travel, training, and lots of work towards helping us all grow up and own our inner shaman and help balance our shadow by balancing the elements in the world. The website, you can go and just get the list of events in less detail, is shamanicbreathwork.org, events page. But also, you can go to Linda Starwolf, and even though I'm beyond my friend limit, you can follow me. I post there all the time. But you can also go to Shamanic Mystery Tours page or Venus Rising Association for Transformation page.
Okay. And those are all Facebook pages, not websites, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, that's clear. Any other parting words?
Well, I hope to see you back out here on top of the mountain. If nothing else, Susan, this area of North Carolina is supposed to be one of the best places in the entire world to see the total solar eclipse. The weekend of August 21st. We have a blue star gathering, which is the next iteration of the Wise Wolf Council. The blue star council gathering here over that weekend, where we'll be going through some beautiful ceremonies, including breath work out on the land in our beautiful medicine wheel on top of the mountain, doing a powerful ceremony around that powerful solar eclipse together.
Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today, Star Wolf, and for your advance invitation to the Blue Star Council. I've already started putting out feelers, at least for transportation support, if not for companionship for the weekend. And if any of this patchy interview is useful to you in promoting your work, please feel free to edit it to suit your needs and use it in whole or in part. Speaking of celestial events, it's the full moon this weekend, and the U.S. will be transitioning into daylight savings time. Does anyone else find it paradoxical that we lose an hour of our life when we spring forward on the clock? Does anyone else wish they would knock it off with this biannual control game and leave the clocks alone? 10 days from now is the vernal equinox. I'd like to think I'll post another show at about that time with an appropriate celebration. But with heat records being broken and polar ice in winter turning in measurements indistinguishable from summer figures of just 35 years ago, and during a La Niña event, no less, I'm not feeling much like celebrating the end of winter. More mundanely speaking, the monthly 4-day driving boycott starts on the weekend this month. So maybe more of you will be willing to participate. It's from the 11th to the 14th, inclusive. This would be a good month to adopt the habit, since next Sunday is the 14th anniversary of the invasion of Iraq, undeniably a war for oil. And speaking of wars, this Thursday is the 49th anniversary of the My Lai massacre. Closer to home, this Wednesday is the 42nd anniversary of the Watts riots in Los Angeles. So make it part of your spiritual practice to refrain from driving for 4 days each month, to grow up, step into sobriety, and take responsibility and perhaps find other ways that you can refuse to participate in this culture of violence and separation. Thanks again to Star Wolf for the virtual visit last Sunday, to our listeners for your patience with our lame tech, and to Zimft for the Sequitur theme music. Until next time, this is Susan Livingston.
What connects us is one.